From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. There are suggestions of political interference surrounding the apparent resignation of the South Pacific Stock Exchange chief executive and other recent dismissals in Fiji. The opposition is calling for investigations into what it says and is an obvious abuse of official procedures. Joe O'Brien reports.
The South Pacific Stock Exchange says its chief executive, Latilita Ngoro, has resigned after taking responsibility for a miscount of votes in the elections for the director of the investment company Fijian Holdings. In media statements, the stock exchange apologised for initially releasing incorrect results to shareholders and noted that certain proxies and votes were invalid. But former Prime Minister Laisini Ngarase, who represented several shareholders at the election, disputes that version of events.
I haven't seen any evidence to support the allegation that there was an error. There was an overwhelming presence of those who supported the other candidate. There was a declaration by the chairman that he had won. It came as a complete shock later in the evening that that decision was reversed.
Ms. Ngarase says the election reversal, which gave victory to a government permanent secretary, was unfair and lacking in transparency.
The change was done within a small group of people who decided on the issue. Without the knowledge of the great majority of the other shareholders. I believe there was a group of people from the government side that virtually interfered in the process of election.
The former Prime Minister says he believes the Stock Exchange CEO was forced to resign. Fiji's Shadow Transport Minister, Asiri Randondro, says her immediate resignation raises questions about whether proper processes were followed.
We just wanted to see that there is a fair process and there is a proper tribunal set in place to ensure that the voices of the people are actually heard and not be one-sided for a decision to be made.
The Shadow Minister says it's becoming blatantly apparent people are being dismissed on the instructions of shadowy powers. He's calling for the Human Rights Commission to investigate a growing trend of terminations occurring without the due process of the law, including 5 dismissals of staff from the Land Transport Authority.
So that's something that we see is becoming an obvious thing on a everyday, on a regular basis now, where people have been terminated and the termination is with immediate effect. This is something that is very alarming.
Fijian Holdings states that its core purpose is to encourage the participation of Indigenous Fijians in the commercial sector and enhance their economic standing. Laisini Ngarase says the longer the government interferes in the running of the company, the worse its results will get.
The surprising thing is that the government has absolutely no financial link with the company. The company had paid off an amount of money that was given to Fijian Holdings years back. They should leave the company alone.
Mr. Ngarase says another election should have been held to clear the air. This is Joe O'Brien.
An opposition politician in Fiji is calling for an independent parliamentary committee to investigate the state's responses to police brutality. The police force has been plagued by regular cases of brutality and torture, most recently involving a teenager who died in police custody nearly 2 weeks ago. But the leader of the National Federation, Biman Prasad, says many investigations are often mishandled and the public is losing faith in the police force. He told Jamie Tahanaha that an independent inquiry can call witnesses, establish whether abuses have been dealt with fairly, and work out an appropriate action plan.
Well, we haven't formulated the motion yet, but we are planning to move a motion in the March sitting of the Parliament for a special committee of Parliament to independently investigate cases of alleged police brutality, breaches of human rights, because we believe that the current practice and procedures for investigation may have been compromised. And we believe that a parliamentary committee would be the best way to independent of the police and the victims, to investigate and report to Parliament for further action.
It's well known these abuse cases go on. What would this parliamentary inquiry achieve?
Well, at least it will bring out the public submission. People will have the opportunity to appear before the committee, as the parliamentary committee will have the powers to call witnesses and others involved in this and the stakeholders, including the police and the victims, so that the parliamentary committee can correctly establish if the alleged abusers have been dealt with fairly and independently, and the victims, the alleged victims, have had the appropriate redress.
To be suggesting this would indicate you don't feel this has happened, that justice hasn't been served or people aren't being treated fairly and equally.
Well, that's the perception, and as we said, that the way in which the victims have been made to run around, and many of them have come to us and given us the appropriate information, we believe that the victims as well as the public seem to be losing the confidence in the current procedures for investigation that we see happening. You'll also note that we do not have an ombudsman. Previously, an ombudsman was a retired judge under the 1997 Constitution, and the ombudsman was also the chairperson of Fiji Human Rights Commission. And so some of these institutions, as provided for in the previous constitution, are not there. And that is why we are saying that in light of the recent alleged cases, and we believe that a parliamentary committee would be the best way to not only get to the bottom of these allegations, but also to ensure that the parliament then considers appropriate institutions to deal with this in the future.
A Pacific academic says Kiribati has sent a strong message by rejecting a Russian businessman's investment proposal, which included a demand for sovereign rights to three of its uninhabited islands. Anton Bakov, who is the founder of Russia's Monarchist Party, had hopes to use the islands to revive the Romanov Empire and create what he called an alternative Russia. He also said that he'd planned to invest about $350 million in Kiribati by building a resort complex on Maldon Island. However, the Kiribati government last week announced it had rejected Mr. Bakov's demand for sovereign rights over three Southern Line Islands as a prerequisite in his investment. Academic and former Tongan politician Siviventi Halapua told Amelia Langford that Kiribati should be congratulated on its stance.
Sovereignty is not something to be bought and sold, you know. This is something that every Pacific Island independent nation are quite jealous about, you know, how they protect the sovereignty of the nation, which is, it's about the security and the safety of the whole nation, of the people as a whole. So I'm very impressed, and you know, the basis for the rejection is not some commercial criteria of some kind, you know. It's based on political criteria, and that's the right decision to make.
This is the second time he's tried to either buy or lease an island in the Pacific. Do you think this is going to send him a message, and of course other foreign investors, that the Pacific can't be bought?
Yeah, I think it should be. It's a very strong message that you know, comes out from Kiribati, and we know, and the world knows, that Kiribati has a lot of very critical challenges with regard to climate change. They need as much money as they can put together to address and mitigate the problem. It's not like any other Pacific Island country. It's not very rich. It's not wealthy. And for Kiribati to stand up and based on their decision as a matter of principle, regardless of their own need and economic challenges and status, I think it's something that ought to be recognized and respected.
Yeah, because once, obviously, you give away sovereignty, you can't get that back, can you?
No. In fact, if you really think in terms of the Pacific Island nation, the small states, is the most important thing that we have is our own sovereignty, you know, just like any other bigger country and wealthy country. And we know that, like, for instance, in the United Nations, the, you know, most powerful international institution, Kiribati has the same vote as the United States of America because of their sovereignty. That really shows how important sovereignty to any of our Pacific Island country. And I think and concretely like Kiribati for recognizing that most important thing they have in their possession.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The company supplying food to more than 170 inmates in a Papua New Guinea jail has now resumed its deliveries after almost a week suspension. The owner of Whiskey Fresh Limited, Barry Mappy, told local media last week that he suspended the service in protest for unpaid bills dating back to November last year. But the acting commissioner of PNG Correctional Services, Stephen Palacis, told Karori Hawkins on Friday that while payment delays are sometimes up to 2 months, many of the claims made by Mr. Mapps are false.
I have responded to that by providing payments done for the three months that he argued that he was not paid. And from the records that we have, payments were done. He has received all his payments for the 3 months.
Well, has he restored services? How are the prisoners faring at the moment?
I made contact with the owner of the company. He came and we had a chat yesterday afternoon at 2:55 p.m. for him to supply food. Actually, I did not know that he actually supplied the food, when was it, on Wednesday evening.
He's resumed services. Was that a one-off on Wednesday or
every
day now since Wednesday?
Wednesday this week, today is Friday. So when I had a chat with him yesterday with one of my assistant commissioners, and I asked him why he raised all those issues to the media, and he said, oh, he was frustrated. But actually, the correctional service has done its payment, and everything should be okay. I told him to continue supplying raisins, and if he does not want to continue with this business, then he should, by all means, write to commissioner informing him that he is withdrawing services so that we can find another reputable supplier that is willing to provide service to Baisu Correctional Institution.
What about the Baisu Jail? Have they been contacted? Do you know if his services have resumed?
Yes. Spoken to commanding officer. They have received the supplies, so everything is back to normal.
That's great news. Now, I understand from the press release, a lot of suppliers for jails have a month or 2 month delays at times with the payment of their fees. Is this just because of process, or is there a budget shortage in this area?
Both. With the budget, here in Papua New Guinea, we have the normal monthly allocations that are given to all government departments, including correctional service. And the monthly allocations, they are not steady. Sometimes there are decreases in the allocation. It's to do with the budget. And secondly, it comes back to claims or the invoices that are submitted. Sometimes they are not submitted as early within the funds that are allocated. So when the invoice comes late, we look to the next month. When the funds come in, then we pay, because we normally spend all the funds within the month.
The fluctuation of the warrant amounts, is that something that's always been happening, or is it just a recent development with the current economic problems?
Yes, it's to do with the recent development that we are facing, especially with the economic situation the country is facing. So it's nationally, it's not only to correctional service.
A campaigner battling to stop the Pacific-wide free trade deal says recent moves by the United States President Donald Trump could lead to tougher conditions for the island countries. Some Pacific countries and Australia and New Zealand have been negotiating for 8 years to try to reach an agreement called Placer Plus. The Pacific Network Against Globalization campaigner Adam Wolfenden told Don Wiseman that Mr. Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership could drive Australia and New Zealand to wrap up Pacer Plus quicker.
Well, I think the collapse of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has, for Australia and New Zealand, presented them with another way to try and frame Pacer Plus. For them, Pacer Plus, I fear, is that they will use it as a way to signal to the rest of the world that they still believe in multilateral trade deals and that they still want to see a regional agreement like PACER Plus go ahead, if for nothing else to say that they still believe that, that this is a sign that Australia and New Zealand are still open for business.
Let's say that that is the New Zealand-Australian approach, and up to now I think there's been no mention of it since the outburst from Donald Trump. But one of the things that Australia and New Zealand could look at is perhaps to moderate some of their positions relative to what they expect from the Pacific Island countries, given the criticism that's come from Donald Trump about the bad deal that America was getting in the TPP.
But what we're seeing is that may not necessarily be the case. The Australian Assistant Minister Keith Pitt was in Fiji only a couple of weeks ago, and you know, it seemed like for Australia the priority was to conclude PACER Plus. They said that 8 years of negotiations is substantial, and it's their intention to push forward with concluding those negotiations. Now, that rhetoric has changed a lot since saying this is a development agreement, this is about the Pacific. And so it seems like Australia's position is shifting to basically saying, you've had 8 years, it's now time to sign up. And from the Fiji perspective, they still have significant concerns about their ability to protect and nurture their infant industries, which I think most people would argue is a key component to any development pathway. And yet Australia and New Zealand don't seem to be shifting on that position, and instead are turning around and putting the pressure on Fiji and other Pacific nations to hurry up and sign up to PACER Plus.
There's this very strong probability that both Fiji and Papua New Guinea won't sign up. So what sort of a deal is it going to be?
Well, I guess to paraphrase President Trump, you could call it a dumb deal at the same time, because the two biggest economies in the region, both in terms of size, but I think also in terms of Fiji, you look at the way that Fiji is an economic hub for the region. To take those two countries out of the deal really sort of undermines a lot of the rhetoric and the purpose that Australia and New Zealand have framed PACER Plus as being. You know, they were saying it was a regional agreement, it's about regional integration. It's hard to have regional integration when you're missing the biggest economy and the regional economic hub. So I think there's a huge question mark as to whether or not those initial claims as to what PACER Plus was about are even being met in form without Papua New Guinea or Fiji.
To an outside observer, it does seem like there's actually nothing in this for New Zealand and Australia. Why are they so adamant that they want to get this signed?
Well, I think it's naive to think that there's nothing in it for Australia and New Zealand, because if you look at the trade figures between, particularly between Papua New Guinea and Fiji and Australia and New Zealand, but not just those countries, the rest of the Pacific as well, they do have significant commercial interests involved in these countries. So they definitely have that aspect to gain from PACER Plus. There's the geopolitics of PACER Plus as well. PACER Plus negotiations were allegedly triggered from the Pacific negotiating a trade deal with the European Union. So the whole premise of PACER Plus has been founded on this belief by Australia and New Zealand that they should have first crack at the Pacific market and they should receive the best treatment. And, you know, so they want to maintain their, I guess, economic influence over the region. So there is a definite interest for Australia and New Zealand to see PACER Plus concluded on terms that they're happy with. Now, that aside, there's also those other reasons of saying there's the ideological approach. They want to see free trade, from their definition, in the region. But what Payne and I think a lot of others have said for a long time is that that's not the reality of the region. This textbook ideology of free trade isn't the Pacific's reality. And we're starting to see that reflected in the Pacific. You can see from the Vanuatu Development Plan, you know, they're starting to really frame and reconceptualize how trade deals should be considered. And, you know, it speaks to saying that any new trade agreements have to demonstrate tangible benefits in the national interest. Now, I would say that PACER Plus would fail that test. And I think that's the sort of conversations and positions we're starting to see pop up more and more in the region.
The Asian Development Bank says Palau is facing urgent infrastructure and environmental challenges due to its booming tourism industry. In a just-released report assessing Palau's private sector, the ADB says the rapid growth of what it calls low-end tourism could damage Palau's natural environment and World Heritage sites, which are crucial to maintaining its thriving tourism industry and generating revenue for the country. That comes after a huge influx of tourists in 2015 and 2016, mostly due to an increase in package tours, predominantly from mainland China. The report's author, economist Paul Holden, told Amelia Langford that the key focus on this type and number of tourists that Palau really wants to attract.
What has happened over the last few years has been an explosion in tourism, which has taken the number of tourist arrivals in the past 5 years from somewhere in the region of 100,000 to close to 180,000. But many people say that the growth of the tourism industry is threatening to degrade the natural beauty sites in Palau. And in fact, they have two World Heritage sites there. And the big danger is that these sites will become overcrowded and thereby destroy the experience. So the center of the debate is the type of tourists that they would like to see. The word that, or the phrase they're using, is they're seeking to attract high-value tourists. And by that, they don't necessarily mean tourists who spend a lot, but really who come to savor the experience of the islands and their natural beauty as a whole, and in doing so wish to return on a regular basis to tell their friends about it and so on.
So the more tourists that come along, the more danger there is that these precious sites will be damaged in some way?
Well, yes. I think it's, you know, there are a number of issues there, one of which is their ability to enforce the existing laws and regulations, firstly, and secondly, to develop new regulations that will protect the environment. Now, last year, 2016, there was a slowdown. This is partly attributable, I think, to the slowdown in economic growth in China, firstly, but secondly, the fact that the US dollar, which is the currency of Palau, has appreciated very strongly against virtually every other currency in the world. So Palau has become significantly more expensive than it was. So to some degree, there is a natural switch back towards higher spending tourists. But there are many other issues that the country has to confront in order to be able to realize its vision of a destination for high-value tourists.
So Palauans in general are very aware, I suppose, of the impact these tourists are having to what is quite a small country.
Oh, and look, absolutely. I have just finished a visit to the country where I presented this private sector assessment. And one feature of Palau, which is, I think, very encouraging, is the degree to which the wider population are involved in the debate regarding the future of the country. And one of the questions at the Economic Symposium, which I was the keynote speaker, was who exactly are we developing the tourism industry for? Are Palauans benefiting from the increase in the number of visitors and so on? And this is, I think, a very healthy development in terms of ensuring that there is a degree of consensus in the country regarding how they move forward.
What is the answer? Are Palauans benefiting at the moment from the tourism industry?
Oh, look, there's no question that they're benefiting. But at the same time, I think a number are quite dismayed at the overrunning of some of the facilities. And so what has still not happened is a clear articulation of the policies that are necessary to put in place in order to realize the pristine paradise Palau vision of the tourist industry and its role in society. There are all sorts of issues like land use planning, overstretching of water and waste facilities, garbage. I mean, some pretty fundamental things, but really things that are quite important.
What you're talking about in terms of Palau would be relevant to a lot of small Pacific nations right now, do you think?
Oh, look, there's no question that that is the case. Why this issue is of particular urgency to Palauans is that their tourist industry is very, very far advanced. And with the possible exception of the Cook Islands, by far the most evolved tourism industry in the Pacific.
How urgent is this problem for Palau?
Urgent. They do not have a long window in terms of being able to indefinitely postpone taking some of the more difficult decisions that have to be made.
The beauty of Taro is being showcased in an unusual form in Cook Islands at an exhibition aimed at celebrating women. This women's work is showing at the Bergman Gallery in Rotonga and features colorful glass and tarot glasses in a performance installation that includes contemporary dance and tarot patch and a tarot patch inside the gallery. The New Zealand-based Cook Islands artist Nevia Negro created the glass tarot sculptures in collaboration with performance director Dion Joseph, who created the dance work installation. Ms. Joseph spoke to Indira Stewart.
Its full title is actually This Woman's Work is a Woman's Work, and it came from her experience working with Puka Pukan women, and Puka Puka is an atoll in the Cook Islands, about 13 years ago. And she experienced working with these women who actually worked in the taro patch. For many of us, we our knowledge of taro is that it's a man's job. Men cultivate the plantation and undertake the harvest. For Puka Pukan women, and Niaval is of Puka Pukan descent as well, it's actually the women who do this work and also often selling the taro as well. And we had a very successful opening at Devonport last year as part of Art Week. And then Niaval was invited to bring the performance installation, as it was now called, to Rarotonga at the Bergman Gallery.
So when the installation was taken to the Bergman Gallery in the Cook Islands, what did that look like?
It was really fascinating because, of course, we had told them what we were going to do, and we said we wanted to bring the culture into the space. And they'd already constructed a frame for us in which to build a taro patch, and that requires kiko being set out, which are palms, dirt, obviously. And we've got these beautiful, very fragile glass but resilient glass sculptures. We actually want it to be alive, and we talked to a number of different people, including the high chiefs, who in the Cook Islands are called the House of Araki, and in particular, Makia Vakatini Joe, who was one of the high chiefs, who helped us by actually providing earth. And then the Ministry of Agriculture heard about our work. They offered us brand new varieties that they'd just been testing, taro plants. And we had the involvement of the entire island, as well as my dancers. My dancers were all local 15-year-old girls who had never done contemporary dance before.
How big was that taro patch?
It was about 4 metres by 3 metres.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pelham, wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.